truth. The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Creole minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, August 9th, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
California decertifies its voting machines. Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars join us for a special in-studio performance and interview. And Iraqi deaths are expected to soon cross the 1 million mark.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. U.S. forces in Iraq claim to have killed 32 suspected militants in a raid in eastern Baghdad earlier this week. But Iraqi police and witnesses say that the raid killed 9 civilians, including 2 women, and wounded 6 others. The death toll in Iraq keeps mounting daily. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University last year had concluded that 601,000 violent Iraqi deaths were attributable to the U.S. invasion as of July 2006. Now, the nonpartisan institute JustForeignPolicy.org has updated that study and are expecting the number of Iraqi deaths to cross the 1 million mark sometime next week. Joining me on the line this morning is Patrick McElwee. He is a policy analyst at JustForeignPolicy.org. Welcome to Uprising, Patrick.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for joining us. It's an incredibly sobering number. It's hard to imagine what 1 million deaths attributable to the U.S. invasion is, really in human terms. First, explain to our listeners how you came up with this number.
Sure. Well, it's a really sobering number, and it's very startling. We think it's the best current estimate of Iraqi deaths. Last year, as you said, researchers from Johns Hopkins University conducted a rigorous scientific study of Iraqi deaths. And it's really the most recent and the only rigorous study we have of Iraqi deaths. And like you said, they estimated as of last July that 601,000 Iraqis had died violently as a result of the invasion. So what we're basically doing is extrapolating from their number. In the absence of another scientific study of that nature, we think that this extrapolation represents a best estimate, and it's currently just under a million Iraqi deaths
so far. Are you assuming the same rate of killings, then, that the Lancet study used?
No, actually, we're not. There's another source on Iraqi deaths that exists out there, which folks may have heard about, is the Iraq Body Count, and they keep an online tabulation of all media-reported deaths, so all deaths that have been reported in at least 2 English-language media sources. And so we're assuming that while they're not capturing all the deaths in Iraq, a scientific study is really needed for that. They're just capturing a subset of the deaths, those that are reported in the press. They're still capturing more or less the rate of death, so that if the rate of death in Iraq has increased over the last year, then the rate of media-reported deaths has also increased, and vice versa. If the deaths had decreased, then the media-reported deaths would have decreased.
Well, that's assuming that the media is still covering the deaths at the same rate as they were before. If the media, in fact, has gotten less able to keep track, then it is a serious underestimate.
That's right. So it's very possible that our extrapolation leads to a serious underestimate, because if it's gotten more violent in Iraq, and if the media is just confined to increasingly small areas of safe passage, then our estimate would be an underestimate. That's correct.
How does this estimate compare to what the United States military keeps track of and claims are the deaths of Iraqis?
Well, the U.S. media made very clear going into Iraq that they would do no body counts on Iraqi civilians. They've made no effort to actually come up with a number. Now, every now and then, the president will say 35,000 Iraqis have died, or a number in that ballpark. We also get numbers from the Iraqi government, but they're also very politically based. For example, last year, before the Johns Hopkins study came out, the health minister of Iraq was saying that there were 50,000 Iraqis who had been killed since the beginning of the invasion. The Johns Hopkins study came out, and the week following, the Iraq health minister tripled his estimate to 150,000 Iraqis, presumably to make it more believable. And so there's no case that that's anything but political.
I'm speaking with Patrick McElwee, policy analyst at justforeignpolicy.org, and we're talking about an estimate of the Iraqi deaths due to the U.S. invasion of 2003 that is expected to reach the 1 million mark next week. So let's talk about some of the about exactly how the deaths are counted. And you're basically counting those deaths that Iraq Body Count uses or keeps track of based on media reports. This is what civilian deaths due to U.S. bombings, but also deaths of Iraqis at the hands of other Iraqis.
For sure, that's what the Iraq Body Count is counting. But we're only using the Iraq Body Count. For this extrapolation, the numbers from the Johns Hopkins study are all Iraqis, and so it doesn't attempt to distinguish between civilians or combatants. And their deaths from all sources, that's right, from coalition, from bombs, from car bombs, from all sources.
Is there any sense that you get that that there are researchers or even the same researchers from Johns Hopkins might be going to update their study to either confirm or better estimate the number that you've come up with?
Well, the researchers who did the Johns Hopkins study are calling for someone to do a follow-up study. They've done two. They did one back in 2004 and then one last year in 2006. These studies aren't easy to conduct. They're they involve some folks taking their lives into their hands to get this data. It's really incumbent on the occupiers of Iraq to do these kinds of studies. It's their obligation under the Geneva Conventions as an occupying force to take care of the Iraqi population. And it's also important for the debate back home so that we know we're informed about what we should do in Iraq, whether it's time for the war to end, and not only what we should do in Iraq, but what we should do in the future. Will we allow our government to invade other countries? Should they invade Iran? And how big should our military be? Does our military need to be big enough to invade and occupy other countries? I mean, is that something that the American people think we ought to be doing?
What does this number of 1 million mean in terms of comparing it to other conflicts? Rwanda comes to mind, but certainly that's not a comparison that you ever hear in the mainstream media.
That's right. Already as of last year, the 600,000 Iraqis had died. That's comparable to how many people were killed in the Rwandan genocide. Most estimates are around 650,000 people killed in Rwanda. So to have had 1 million Iraqis killed, that's more than died in the Rwandan genocide. That's more than anyone says were killed under Saddam Hussein or by Saddam Hussein's forces. It's a devastating number. It really is. You have to add on top of that, of course, the 2 million people who are estimated to have fled Iraq to other countries, and the additional about 1.8 million people who have been displaced from their homes inside the country of Iraq.
Patrick, let's talk about responsibility here. It seems that the United States military may only hold itself responsible, if that, for the deaths of civilians killed from U.S. bombs as quote-unquote collateral damage, but probably not any of the deaths that are as a result of the unfolding civil war in Iraq. What do you think about that?
Well, that's clearly not an acceptable position. I mean, the deaths of the Civil War are clearly deaths that have happened because the U.S. invaded Iraq. The Civil War was clearly unleashed by processes that began when the U.S. invaded Iraq. And probably the most important cause of the Civil War was the basic dismantling of the Iraqi state. But even if we set those deaths aside, if we look at the number Johns Hopkins came up with, they actually asked people how were their family members killed. And in about 45% of the cases, they didn't record an answer because if there was any uncertainty on the part of the family, they didn't record an answer. But for those where they did record an answer, 56% of the time, the family said that their family members had been killed by coalition forces.
56% of the time.
That's right.
So we're talking about more deaths at the hands directly of U.S. forces than of other Iraqis.
That's right. That's what they found. And this sounds unbelievable to people, but what we need to remember is that there's a lot going on in Iraq that's not being reported. For example, in January of this year, Britt Hume from Fox News went as an embedded reporter with some pilots on an airstrike in Iraq. That airstrike, they bombed 25 targets that day. None of the damage from where those bombs fell was reported in the press. Every day for the past several years, U.S. forces have gone on about 1,000 patrols every day into hostile neighborhoods, going from house to house, apartment to apartment. Since February, that number has increased to about 5,000 as a result of the so-called surge.
Right.
To count the Iraqi force.
So we are there are even more of those happening this year than last year.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And lethal force is often engaged during these patrols, and it's just not reported.
So, Patrick, at this point, using this number that your organization and that you have helped come up with, 1 million Iraqis, at least as of next week, are expected to have died as a result of the U.S. invasion. What are you calling for? What sort of action are you calling on the American people to take?
Well, we're asking people to contact Congress. I mean, certainly we have some momentum in this country after the last November's elections. To get out. And the American people clearly want this war to end. And so what's needed now is some organized pressure on our leaders to end this war. And so on our website, we have various actions that are constantly updated so folks can write into Congress, they can get together and watch videos and basically organize in their communities.
I understand you have a petition based on this number.
That's right. We do have a petition asking Congress to do a study of how many Iraqis have died, which is important for making policy. It's important also for things like answering the question of whether the United States should pay reparations to Iraq for the damage it's done there.
And again, the website is justforeignpolicy.org. Patrick McElwee, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Patrick McElwee is a policy analyst at the nonpartisan organization JustForeignPolicy.org, and it's at that website that you can see the frequently updated web counter as well that is counting Iraqi deaths directly due to the U.S. invasion. The number of deaths is expected to surpass 1 million next week, and it is essentially extrapolating from the study that was done by Johns Hopkins University researchers and published in the Lancet last year. Again, the website is justforeignpolicy.org. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we will speak with Jim March once more. We heard from him last week about a study showing that California voting machines can be hacked into. California has since decertified three of the voting machine systems used in the state, so we'll get an update on that. And after this week's Radical Day in History, we'll hear from Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. Quite a treat. They join us in studio for an in-studio performance and interview, so don't tune out for that.
Del Mate Productions presents Fiesta Argentina 2007, Tangos of Yesterday and Today. At the Ford Amphitheater on Saturday, August 18 at 8 p.m., Tangueto brings the tangos of today. Guillermo Galvea and the Los Angeles Tango Quartet present the classics of yesterday. And the Otero Dance Company brings the passionate dance of tango. The Ford Amphitheater is located at 2580 Cahuenga Boulevard East in Hollywood. For tickets, call 323-461-3673 or visit www.fordtheaters.org.
People, the time has come.
This is your radio reporter, Hannah George. On this day, August 9th in 1945, during World War II, the U.S. military detonated the nuclear bomb, Fat Man, over the Japanese city of Nagasaki, only 3 days after dropping the bomb that devastated Hiroshima. The Nagasaki bombing had an estimated 74,000 casualties, almost all of whom were civilians. The U.S. had warned Japan that it would face the full force of the United States if it didn't surrender, but the enormous size of these attacks was still unexpected. At that time, most of the world, including Japan, had no knowledge that the U.S., under its secret Manhattan Project, was researching and producing nuclear weapons. Japan has sought the global abolition of nuclear weapons ever since, a commitment rooted in the trauma and suffering caused by the bombings. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you.
Say it, say it, say it. Welcome back to Uprising. The Sierra Leone Civil War, which started in the early 1990s, resulted in tens of thousands of deaths and more than 2 million refugees. It was a brutal 11-year-long conflict that involved the recruitment of child soldiers, amputations, and decapitations. The war ended by 2002, but for the millions of Sierra Leonean refugees in neighboring countries, there was still too much fear to return to their homeland. The refugees in neighboring Guinea are the subject of an acclaimed multi-award-winning documentary called Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. That's also the name of a music band comprised of refugees that the film focuses on. The film is directed by Zach Niles and Banker White and traces the band's foundation and battle to stay together amidst their country's brutal decade-long civil war. The members of Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars have a repertoire that heavily draws on their first-hand experiences as refugees of war. They have now returned to their homeland where they recorded their first album, Living Like a Refugee. The documentary recently aired on PBS and is available to order on Netflix. It will be available for purchase through Netflix Red Envelope on DVD on August 14th, that's next week. For every DVD purchased, Red Envelope will donate $1 to the United Nations 9million.org, which is an initiative aimed strictly at refugee youth worldwide. Four of the nine band members joined me in studio last week during their U.S.-Europe tour, and they shared their music and words.
Aliye Congo ma feneba imalo kele manyi Aliye Iraki ma feneba imalo kele manyi Aliye Somali ma feneba imalo kele manyi kele manyi de
Anekele bila kele manyi
Amasalo
Anekele bila kele manyi
Farabindelo
Anekele bila kele manyi
Amubalo
Anekele bila kele manyi
Farabindelo
Anekele bila kele mani
Anyebe anyebe imalo kele mani Anyebe anyebe imalo kele mani Aliye Sierra Leone mafenema imalo kele mani Aliye Rwanda mafeneba imalo kele manyi Aliye Iraki mafeneba imalo kele manyi Aliye Sudani mafeneba imalo kele manyi kele manyi de
Anekele bila kele manyi
Amazano
Anekele bila kele manyi
Marabindelo
Anekele bila kele manyi
Amubano
Anekele bila kele manyi Anekele bila kele mani
Amasalu
Anekele bila kele mani.
And that's the sound of Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. They joined me in studio this morning. Thank you so much for coming in, and thanks for that beautiful song. I'd like to introduce my four guests, Ruben Koroma, Ashade Pierce, Black Nature, and Idrissa Malam Bangora. Welcome.
Thanks.
Ruben, I'd like to begin with you. You are the founder of the Refugee All-Stars. How did it all start? How did you guys all get together?
Well, really, it was when we were forced to quit our country, and then we went to the neighboring country, which is Guinea. We resided there, you know, and we live in a refugee camp. But a refugee camp, it's like a situation that is never too good for every human being. And I personally was thinking, you know, it very deeply. I thought that it's my responsibility as an artist to do something to, in order to minimize, you know, the trauma that the people we are really facing. And so I choose music. I found music as something that will I mean, keep people alive and give people hope. So I decided, I have the intention of making a group in a refugee situation, I think. And so I started looking out for musicians. I found the first person in 1998 who was Franco Nero in the camp. He managed to have escaped with his guitar. And so when I disclosed my intention to him, he really cooperated. And then we started entertaining people, you know, three of us, Franco, me, and my wife, Grace. And then, not too late, we got another person who became very much interested. And he's also a talented person. He's called Abubakar Peni Kamara. He's a late man now. But he really plays an important instrument, you know, that comes from our country, which is called Kongoma, you know. It's a kind of instrument that produces percussion and the bass tune of music, you know. And it's really helped us tremendously because we barely had only one guitar. And so that instrument really helped us tremendously.
So you only had one guitar between all of you?
Yes, when we started, you know. And so we kept playing music, you know, in that situation. And then we made improvised percussion, you know. And so that's how it all started.
I notice you're improvising a little percussion today yourself in the back of a little paper cup.
Yes.
Is that something you typically do?
Yeah, well, we are used to it now, you know.
Do you write most of the songs that the Refugee All-Stars play?
Oh, yes, I do.
What was that last song that you just sang us? What was that about?
The song is Kelemanyi, and Kelemanyi is in Mandingo, you know. It says, Kelemanyi, war is not good. Let us stop war, because war is never too good. You know, that's the meaning.
Did I hear the words Iraq and Sudan?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because I said, look at Iraq, look at Sudan, look at Somalia. You know, you know that war is not good. So it's our time we stop war.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you guys have another piece you can play? And I'd like to bring Black Nature into the conversation. You're, I think, the youngest member of the band. And you are also, I noticed in the film that you're, that focuses on your band, you're a fan of Busta Rhymes. Tell our listeners a little bit about how you got into hip-hop and how do you bring that into the music of the Refugee All-Stars?
Well, of course, first of all, when I was in the refugee camp, I used to look at TV and musical clips, and of course I was doing my own rap stuff, and I got the inspiration through Busta Rhymes because I used to watch at the TVs, and we are in. Mr. Ruben and the other crew, we are playing music in the refugee camp, and I decided to go around them so that I will have more experience. Wherever they play, I used to go to see their concert, and I started going around him, and he thought that, oh, if I develop this young guy, and he will be somebody tomorrow. And he started encouraging me in the musical field.
Can you share some of your rap with our listeners today? Maybe in one of your songs?
We have one song which we call Compliment to the Peace. You know, I think it tells about... It just given praises to those that bring peace in our home country.
Would love to hear that.
Okay, well, my own verse goes like this. Now, peace, love, or unity, they make you to my FIFA tea. So, my can eat your bro, forget what you be, don't be he. The we say, no, say, now, but yes, I be, don't do. Forgiven and forget what you happen, not the country. Wouldn't be the thief, wouldn't be the loot, wouldn't be the thief, wouldn't be the loot, wouldn't be the thief, because of peace another day. So, every day and night, we the land. So, every night, I say the peace another day. So, the big level fetch for this peace, peace. A good last in our country, home. It goes like that.
Wonderful. Well, are you guys ready to play another song?
Yeah, we want to play another song which will allow Black Nature to give us the modern flavor, and that's why we like him, because, you know, I just want to say, when we started playing music in the camp, he was like a very little boy, and he was coming around us. You know, he used to admire us, you know. And then when he goes out to his companions, I would see him rapping, and then his companions are clapping for him. So immediately I recognize that, I know that too, he has the talent, but we need to develop his talent. So we started giving him the opportunity of flowing, just flow in our music. So when we play our music, we say, Black Nature, come and flow. And then when he flows, it's like the youths of the camp are excited, and everybody will start to shout. So we saw that it can be very much important for him to really incorporate the modern flavor into our music.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So we're going to give it a soundtrack, Weapon Conflict.
Let's do it. By the way, if you are a listener sponsor at KPFK, and we do check that you are, and you haven't won anything from us in the past 6 months, call us now at 818-985-5735, and we'll send the first five callers a DVD of the documentary Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. That's
818-985-5735. When two elephants are fighting,
the grass them a suffer.
Which is the position of the civilian or the crowd?
Them a big fool.
Nah, 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 nah.
Them a big fool.
Nah, 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 nah.
Them a big fool.
Have mercy for the vulnerable.
Them a big fool.
Have mercy for the youth.
Them a big fool.
Have mercy for the women.
Them a big fool.
Have mercy for the children.
Them a big fool.
Nah, 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 nah.
Them a big fool.
Them
a be fool us.
We are the
suffer. Them a be fool us. The weapon of this father say,
will you sing it again?
Weapon of this father say, come power.
Again and again.
The weapon of this father say, come power.
When two elephants them fight,
we guys them a suffer.
Fighting.
The guys them a suffer.
Which is in position of the civilian or the crowd?
Them a big fool.
Nah, 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 nah.
Them a big fool.
Nah, 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 nah.
Them a big fool. Them a big fool. Them a big fool.
Them a big fool.
Them a big fool.
Them a big fool.
Them a big fool.
Nah, 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 nah.
Them a big fool. Them a big fool us. Them a big fool us.
The weapon conflicts for the sake of power. The weapon conflicts for the sake of money. So Rafika built on the work and then the people that bought the cross, because the situation is rough. So fighting for money, but I'm looking for Jesse. So West Africa, Sierra Leone, great, crazy. But know you amputate your children and you make them under. Some even grow and some even die. So what about your brothers? You treat them like a beast. He's a positive behavior that we need in the West. You are the best, Sierra Leone. You are the best. You are the best. Black Nature, you are the best.
That's a war.
Will you sing it again?
Weapon conflicts for the sake of power.
Again and again.
Weapon conflicts for the sake of power.
The That's the sound of Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. Four of the band members join me in studio, and I want to turn to you, Malam. You are one of the Refugee All-Stars, and I understand that along with the others, you've been a refugee out of Sierra Leone in Guinea, although have you returned back now to your country?
Yes, I've returned back.
And how did music allow you to deal with the trauma or, you know, just the day-to-day life of a refugee?
Well, you know, music at times makes people forget of all their troubles. So because of it, I play music to satisfy myself, to forget of what had happened to me. Like the way I leave my country, I was punished on the way, no food, no place to sleep. So myself, I decided to say, let me just keep on playing music. Maybe God will help me one day. So now I've decided to play music because people love to listen to music and forget of what had happened to them during the course of the war.
How did you become a refugee?
Well, because of shooting and constant of killing in my country, I was afraid. So I ran away. I went to the camps, but I felt I was safe there. So I became a refugee, whereas I was not expecting to become a refugee. But the war causes me to leave my country.
Are you happy to be back?
Yes, I'm happy because there is peace now in my country.
Ashari, you stayed in Freetown. You chose to not, or you at least had the opportunity to not leave your country. Why is that?
Well, it's because when the war was started, we were unfortunate to go out of the country. You see, so we are there till the war ends.
So you've stayed throughout?
Yes. Indeed.
Have people now returned? Has normalcy mostly returned to the country?
People have returned now because there is peace now in the country. Yes.
So now that you are no longer refugees, how has your music changed? I mean, has the content of your songs become different? Are you writing different songs now than you were when you were a refugee?
Yes, sometimes, you know, because a musician is just like a journalist. We look at what is happening, the current happening. That's what we deal with. You know, at that time, there was war in my country and a refugee situation. So I have to write about a refugee situation and war situation. But for now, I'm touring, so it's like I'm rolling everywhere. So I have to talk about it. And then sometimes talk about current things that are happening right now because, you know, what is really disturbing mankind, you know. We are a group who we like really to talk about, things that are not good for everybody, you know.
Right. Black Nature, did you ever imagine that you'd be traveling to the United States and that you would, you know, be sharing your music with the rest of the world, not only through the documentary but also through the first album?
Well, of course, it's just like a miracle for me, you know. I was not thinking of this short opportunity. You know, as I was saying, when I was in the refugee camp, I was totally hopeless, you know. And I was frustrated. I was not even thinking of short opportunity to come to my memory.
Have you had the chance to meet any rappers here in the U.S.?
Well, of course, they do write me letters like Ice Cube and...
You got a letter from Ice Cube?
Yeah.
Well, that must have been nice.
You know, and I met with most of the famous artists here in the U.S., United States, like the Aerosmith, Joe Perry, and Stevie Tyler. We even made a song together with the Refugee All-Stars,
mm-hmm.
You know?
What was it like, Malam and others, to record your first album? That scene's captured in the documentary, and it seemed like a very important step for the band.
Oh, yeah, it's very important for the band. Me, myself, I was happy to go to the studio through the band's opportunity. And now I'm in the United States of America, so I was very happy.
What is your message to people who... You know, have no idea what war is like. You all have lived through war, and there are still so many people in this world who support war as a means to end conflict. here in the United States, we have a government that supports war, that is pursuing aggressive policies throughout the world. What is your message to pro-war forces in the world?
Well,
Ashari?
Well, my message is to tell the people that war is not good. War is not a problem solver. By war, I think you will, your country will destroy. You destroy, you lost your life, people's lives. Everybody, country will destroy. So war is not good.
Ruben?
Well, to me, I always say to people, like, it does not make sense to go to war. You know, it doesn't make sense, actually, to go to war in order to solve a situation, you know. But, well, some people might choose war to as a solution. Well, everybody has his own mind and everybody has his own thoughts, you know. People might think that, well, we cannot solve this problem except we go to war. And then they go to war. That's what they cherish. But for me as a singer, and the only message I have for them, there is no winner in a war situation. Everybody is a loser. So I think there are a million ways of solving problems rather than going to war. And I think going to war is the worst.
Well, on that note, I want to thank the four of you very much for joining us today. Maybe you could leave us with one final song from your repertoire.
Yes. I think we are going to give you one song and wishes. We just want to tell you how we keep on rolling.
Okay.
We roll everywhere now in the world, you know, carrying the good message.
Mm.
Tomorrow if
I keep rolling, rolling for the better, rolling for our lives, rolling for our sympathy. We are the glance of the energy.
Settle tomorrow,
if I keep rolling, we're rolling for the better, rolling for our lives, rolling for our sympathy. We are the clans of the NHL.
We're rolling, roll Chicago, roll Canada, we roll Sweden, we roll Norway. Roll Australia, oh yes, we rolling. Look how we rolling. Our rolling stone never gather no riches, yeah.
No riches.
Our rolling stone never gather no property,
no property.
Our rolling stone never gather no more,
no more.
Our rolling stone never stable.
Tomorrow
if I keep rolling, we're rolling for the better.
You're listening to four of the nine members of Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars performing in studio last week, Ruben Koroma, Ashade Pierce, Black Nature, and Malam. The documentary Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars is available to order on Netflix. It will be available for purchase through Netflix Red Envelope on DVD on August 14th. For every DVD purchased, Red Envelope will donate $1 to the United Nations' 9million.org, which is an initiative aimed strictly at refugee youth worldwide. For more information, visit www.sierraleonesrefugeeallstars.com. Very special thanks to Mark Maxwell for engineering and editing this interview, and congratulations to the five listener sponsors who just won DVDs.
We keep a roller on the hole, you're rolling, rolling like a rolling stone. Today you settle, tomorrow you pack. We're rolling. Today you settle, tomorrow you pack. We're rolling, yeah. We're rolling like a rolling stone.
You are listening to Uprising, and after this week's Peace Vigil announcements, we'll find out why California recently decertified its voting machines. Stay tuned.
It's time now for our weekly Peace Vigil announcements. I'm Tony. Neighborhood activists all over Southern California hold regular peace vigils to end the war in Iraq. Each week, we announce just some of the 50-plus vigils that are taking place. Complete listings of all the vigils are available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. On Fridays in Burbank, there is a peace vigil from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on the corner of Palm and San Fernando. The information line is 818-842-5055. On Sundays in Highland Park, there's a peace vigil from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Veterans Memorial Square at North Figueroa in York. The information line is 323-899-0698. On Wednesdays in Orange, there's a peace vigil from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Traffic Circle in Old Town Orange at Chapman Avenue and Glassell Street, Code Pink Orange County Chapter. The email contact is kathy@codepinkoc.org. On Wednesdays in West Covina, there's a peace vigil from 7 to 9 p.m. on the corner of Vincent and Lakes by Applebee's Restaurant, one block south of the I-10 freeway. The information line is 310-968-5821. On Fridays in West Hollywood, there's a peace vigil from 7 to 8:30 p.m. on the corner of Santa Monica Boulevard and San Vicente Boulevard. The information line is 818-953-5096. On Wednesdays in San Bernardino, there's a peace vigil at 7 p.m. on E Street, between 2nd Street and Court Street. It's a candlelight vigil. The email contact is dkalke@cclm.org. On Thursdays in Pacific Palisades, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 6 p.m. on the northeast corner of Sunset Boulevard and Swarthmore. The information line is 310-573-1901. A complete list of vigils is available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. Special thanks to Jennifer Hiller.
Welcome back to Uprising. Last Friday, California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen decertified three voting systems widely used in the state. She made the decision in response to studies showing that the machines could be hacked. It affects systems made by three of the four largest voting machines company, including Diebold Election Systems and Sequoia Voting Systems. Last week, we spoke with Jim March with the group Black Box Voting on the study done by computer science scientists, which showed how the machines can be hacked into to change results. Jim joins us back on Uprising to update us on the significance of Deborah Bowen's decision. Welcome back, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing very well. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, does Deborah Bowen's decision really mean that these voting systems will not be used in elections?
Well, what she's done in California so far is limited the use of the worst, the very worst kind of voting machine, the DREs, to one machine per precinct, and to be used only by the disabled and a small number of others. In other words, instead of taking in all the votes in each precinct on these kinds of machines, She's limited them to just those voters who really need to use them for accessibility purposes, plus a small number of others, like five others, so as to ensure voter privacy. In other words, if only one voter, Joe in a wheelchair or whatever, is the one that votes on the DRE, then you know how he voted when you look at the DRE tape later. So if you mix him up with five others, okay, now the poor guy's got privacy. So that makes sense. But overall, it limits the potential damage that those systems can do. But as Bowen correctly points out, the rest of the product line for each company, where the central tabulator is, the optical scan processing systems, and the mail-in vote processing systems, are all flawed, each in their own special way.
Now, Jim, August 5th article in the New York Times said that that Deborah Bowen would let counties use the machines in February's presidential primary if extra security precautions were taken.
Yes, but in the case of the DRE, that's one of the security precautions, that there's only one allowed per precinct. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that 100% of the vote on those DREs is counted by hand afterwards.
What about security precautions on other types of machines?
Well, she's put a variety of security measures in place. We're still analyzing just how much help those will be. We think they'll help, but whether they'll act to prevent insider manipulation of the vote, we can't be certain. We're still analyzing, quite honestly.
Okay, so if there are these security precautions being taken, is there going to be room for the use of traditional paper ballots?
Well, that's a very good question. There's unfortunately two problems with that. One, we don't have a structure in place to get enough warm bodies available to do the level of hand counting necessary. We need to create that structure in order to do hand counting. Now, it's possible any of several ways. One, declare a school holiday and use high school juniors and seniors and maybe some college kids to working on their as part of their civics class or something to provide enough warm bodies. Another method is change the vote to a Saturday instead of a Tuesday. Hmm. Now you've got enough enough off-work volunteers to maybe do hand counting. And the third another barrier to hand counting, separate from who does it, is simply the number of things we vote on in America is enormous compared to other countries. We vote on, elected offices all the way down to dog catcher. We've got propositions, initiatives, this, that, and the other thing. And it adds up to a much larger ballot than you see in countries like Canada, for example, which has done very successful hand counting. So that alone is a barrier to hand counting that I don't think we want to change anytime soon.
What about optical scanning systems?
Well, optical scanning, in theory, can be more secure than touchscreen, but only if it's done right. One of the things we'd like to see is optical scan systems that produce an independent graphic record of each ballot as a graphic snapshot that all get saved to CD, and those can then be distributed out to the media, activists, historians, whoever wants to see them later. The reason those graphic scans, and they could either be watermarked so they can't be altered later or otherwise technologically protected on the media. They would be distributed, for example, on a CD-ROM, which can't be changed. Those graphic scans could then be tabulated by anybody's computer process, not just the one the county happened to have purchased from Sequoia or ESS or Diebold or whatever. If other people could do independent tabulations of the vote on different computer systems than what the county uses, then mm-hmm. you've got an extra level of security. We're talking about a world in which each media outlet goes to election headquarters on election night with their fastest gaming-class computer so they can get the graphic scans and churn through a tabulation, a calculation, faster than anybody else to get an early result out.
Right.
Quicker.
Now, Jim, how have voting industry executives reacted to Deborah Bowen's decision made last Friday? And also, is this decision going to have an effect on the national level regulating these machines?
Well, to answer your first question, they have criticized the thoroughness and integrity and fairness of the California testing, and I believe very unfairly. They've claimed, for example, that, well, the people who did, for example, the red team attack, the penetration testing, security evaluation, had the same level of inside access that an election official would have. And they say, well, that's not fair. Well, I'm sorry, but most vote hacking incidents in America have been performed, the people punished have been election officials and other insiders. There's a couple of people from Sequoia went to jail for vote hacking in Louisiana. Actually, a couple more Sequoia people from at least one Sequoia employee jailed in New Jersey for vote hacking. So insiders are the number one threat. And second, you've got former county election officials and former voting system employees who are out on the streets free, who have the same kind of knowledge that that the system testers in California were given. So it was not an unfair test. Now, as far as repercussions, the very latest, just a few days ago, is the city of Tucson has banned the use of DREs in voting in their city election. So we're starting to see county and city election officials, city of Tucson's pretty big, almost 300,000 population, take note of the California study and react accordingly. So it is starting to do a national push. And finally, we're seeing an effort to do congressional hearings in Washington, D.C., on what all this massively failed tests mean on a national level affecting federal reform legislation. So Deborah Bowen definitely moved the ball forward.
Now, finally, Jim, I understand there is a House Resolution 811, the Voter Confidence and Increased Accessibility Act of 2007.
Yes.
Do you think that that is an adequate act, and will it be spurred on by these results?
Well, that bill is an interesting one because it started out very good. It set a very high level for not just voting security, but voting transparency. You need independent eyeballs on the process and on the software in order to be able to trust it. Unfortunately, a lobbying effort watered down a lot of the transparency provisions. A lot of that lobbying effort came out of Microsoft. All these worst voting systems are built on Microsoft Windows code, and Microsoft doesn't want voting rights activists being able to see how Windows works.
Right.
They view this as, one small skirmish in their overall battle for market domination for Windows.
And in fact,
that
we did talk about that last week. Jim, unfortunately,
yes.
We are out of time, but
no
I want
problem.
To thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank
Jim,
you.
Jim March is on the board of directors of Black Box Voting, and you can find out more at blackboxvoting.org. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Wendell Phillips, who once said, "Governments exist to protect the rights of minorities. The loved and the rich need no protection. They have many friends and few enemies." That's Wendell Phillips, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Our engineer and director this morning has been Tamika Zoghi. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website. Uprising's website is linked through KPFK's website at kpfk.org. Just click on Programs in the left column and scroll all the way down until you find our site. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks for listening.